Hey, folks, we have got a little bit of everything coming up for you on This Week in Law. We've got Professor Jason Rantanen, Venkat Balasubramani, Evan Brown, and me. We're going to have a little fun with the DMCA, with Beyonce, with Sir Mix-a-Lot, Jonathan Colton, and Glee. We're going to talk about getting at your social media accounts and whether sex offenders should be entitled to have such accounts. That and a whole lot more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is 12. This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, recorded January 25th, 2013. No spam in heaven. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWILL to receive $10 off at checkout. And by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWILL. Hi, folks. Thanks so much for joining us today for This Week in Law. I am Denise Howell, and we're here with an excellent panel of folks to talk about everything that's happening in the world of technology law. Joining us once again on the show is Venkat Balasubramani. Hello, Venkat.
Hi there, Denise.
Great to have you back.
Thank you.
I'm doing stupendously. It's an excellent Friday here in Southern California. A little cloudy, a little gloomy, but it should be. It's January, right?
Same here in Seattle, not surprisingly.
Yeah. We are hanging in there. Hey, joining us from Iowa and a first-timer on This Week in Law is Jason Rantanen. Hello, Jason.
Hello. It's not quite so warm here. It's quite a bit colder.
Yes, I can imagine. Jason is a professor at the University of Iowa College of Law and a contributor to the Patently O blog. Are you friends with Dennis Crouch over there?
Yes, we went to law school together, actually. That's where we first met, and we've known each other for quite a while.
That's great. Dennis, I've known since probably the early 2000s because he was one of the first law bloggers out there. So it's great that Patently O is still going strong, and it's got great contributors like yourself.
Thank you.
Also with us is Evan Brown from Chicago, and the Info Law Group. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise, I'll leave it to you to do the singing, but it's great to talk to you as as always. You know. I think I agree with you. Stupendously is a great way to describe things today. So, yeah, great to be on the show. Happy to be here.
Yeah, lots to talk about. I'll say from the get-go that lots of people have been asking me, are we going to talk about Mega or are we going to talk about Mega this week? And I don't think we're going to talk about Mega simply because I haven't quite gotten my arms around it yet. What they've done is launch. I don't think there's much you can really talk about here at the launch about, you know, their potential liability for copyright infringement. We'll just have to let the site unfold and learn a bit more. You know, I haven't signed up for it. I don't even know how it works yet. I want to get a better idea, you know, whether it might be lining itself up for the kinds of trouble that Mega Upload got into. Also, I understand there's a good privacy discussion to be had there. I want to have that discussion, but probably not on this show. Let us digest Mega a bit more. But we will talk about a lot of other interesting topics. And let's start with some in the realm of entertainment. All right. I wanted to talk about a post over at Read Write Web, say that one 10 times fast. To kick things off on a fun note today, John Paul Titlow over there put together a compendium of what he thought were the most outrageous examples of things that got posted to YouTube and then taken down per a DMCA notice. And the funny thing is, I think, you know, he was trying to make a very cut and dried list of things that should not have been taken down. And he's got the Lens v. Universal example of someone having the Prince song Let's Go Crazy in the background of her child dancing. And the mega upload video of all the artists who, you know, had participated willingly in this video, but their record labels were not so thrilled with that. And the video has gone up and down, up and down. Also, the one, and I'm pretty sure we've talked about all of these on the show at one point or another, where YouTube's content ID system bounced a video, flagged it, and took it down because of bird songs in the background of a video about picking a salad. So there are some strange things that happen. The one that he highlighted, one he didn't highlight that I thought should have been there, are all the examples of when one arm of an entity such as, say, Viacom has posted a video and another arm, you know, for marketing or promotional purposes, and another arm of it has pulled it down for copyright purposes, you know, right hand not talking to left. I thought the Buffy versus Edward one was an interesting one to highlight here because this is something I had not read before, but in the article here, it was mentioned that the Copyright Office had actually held this up as a shining example of fair use. What do you guys think about that? Did you look at this Buffy versus Edward, Buffy the Vampire Slayer versus Edward from Twilight remix? I hadn't seen this one before, but it actually wouldn't have surprised me that the media companies involved would have an argument that this should come down. And I think the fair use might be kind of more tenuous than it's presented here. Evan, what do you think of this one?
Well, I hadn't seen it either. And, you know, maybe I should be proud of myself that it had flown under my radar, you know, because I try not to pay too much attention to Buffy and the Twilight series and other, you know, I'll stick with the good stuff, the originals in the genre, you know, actually Bram Stoker's Dracula, if I'm going to be interested in. And I can take it all the way up to the mid-80s with Lost Boys. Okay, but setting all that aside, you know, yeah, there's quite a bit of content here. And one of the things, one of the hallmarks of a transformative or a certain type of transformative use, if we're going to dive into a fair use analysis, is the like a parody is often seen as a transformative use. And I'm not so sure that we're seeing what would mostly be characterized, what most people would characterize as a parody here, because it doesn't seem to be necessarily lampooning or doing too much to comment on these works. It's just taking them and making a new work. That still arguably is transformative, but transformative in a different way than what might be one's impulse to conclude when usually stuff like this is stitched together in a manner like this. So, yeah, I think it's pretty arguable. I think I join in what you say that the entertainment companies have some legitimate arguments against this being fair use, and to that extent, I'm surprised that the Copyright Office cited it as a shining example of fair use. I think it's much more debatable, much more up to discussion like this, and certainly not something that should be like per se or prima facie fair use by any stretch of the imagination.
Venkat, can you think of any fun DMCA takedown examples that didn't get included here?
Well, I can't think of an actual takedown, but I saw this cool video of NFL highlights that were like lip dubbed, and
yeah.
I don't know if anybody else saw that, but when I saw that, the first thing I thought is, wow, I wonder how long it's going to take for this to be taken down. And I think Evan raises a good point, which is, you know, the fair use, was the Buffy clearly fair use? And I think I wonder how much our definition of fair use is evolving in the GIF, the BuzzFeed era, is something like a repetitive GIF. I'm never sure how to pronounce that. I know I even read the article.
I don't know who you asked.
That explained it. But, you know, I think it kind of raises the question of to what extent fair use is evolving. I would agree that I took a quick look at the video when the article came out, and it was gray to me. It wasn't certainly not an obvious example of fair use.
All right. Jason, did you take a look at these and any takeaways for our audience about the state of the DMCA?
Well, I do find them in this gray area. They're not, none of these are so extreme that you can't imagine, or I can't imagine there being a viable takedown, except for the Birdsong one, which the article notes wasn't actually taken down in the end.
Right. It was just flagged.
I mean, given that they're in this gray area, I think it brings up the larger question of how much should copyright holders think about fair use when they're going to send a DMCA takedown notice. I think that's the ultimate question. And given how complex it is, it's maybe a burden shifting issue. Who do we place the burden of deciding whether or not this is a fair use on? Should it be on the copyright holder before it sends the notice? Maybe that might be a reasonable place to place the burden here.
And that's one of the things that could really stand to benefit from copyright reform. You know, we talk about copyright reform quite a bit, you know, maybe making the statutory damages system less favorable to copyright trolls, you know, other ways to make it more efficient to get protection rather than registration, things like this. And this is probably one area, you know, kind of outlining the contours of fair use more clearly would be one way that copyright would really benefit from a type of reform. And I guess along those lines, maybe even saying something a little bit differently here, one thing that I would take issue with what seems to be kind of the underlying premise of this article here is using these examples of copyright takedowns as using them as examples that make the law look outdated. I don't know for sure if that's what necessarily is the lesson that we're taught here, that copyright law is outdated in this respect. The DMCA works in most situations, and there are certainly some situations out there on the fringe where it's abused. I'm not so sure, and this is kind of harkening back to some of the stuff I was saying last week about, why do we always have to be so quick to think about amending the laws? Maybe we should just work on norms and sensibilities in this situation about how copyright holders should responsibly act in sending DMCA takedown notices. So my point is I take a little bit of an issue to say that this necessarily means that the DMCA takedown procedure needs to totally be revamped.
Yeah, I agree with you that, that we're not really dealing with a problem with the law here, but a problem with how it's been implemented and is being implemented on the YouTube site and what people are able to accomplish under the law. Because it's just not possible to pay individualized attention to each and every video that gets uploaded.
If I could just add one thing, I think the Lens case that where this is the Universal Prince baby takedown case, mm-hmm. the order that was recently issued yesterday or day before that denied the parties' cross motions for summary judgment is a great read and kind of really delves into the detail of what a party should consider in sending a takedown notice and really highlights the fact that it's fairly easy to get something taken down. It's fairly difficult to get damages for something that's quote unquote wrongfully taken down. And for better or worse, that's pretty much the current state of the law. So I think that's a great case to read just to get a sense of where things pan out on both sides.
That's great. And thank you for putting Joe Mullen's piece over at Ars Technica in our rundown. I am going to, in turn, because I hadn't done that yet, put it in our list of stories for today's show. And folks can access that at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/195. And it's worth noting, too, that this case has been around for a really long time. It was filed in 2007 and is just now resolving summary judgment motions. So, who knows when it will even get to a trial, but hopefully sooner rather than later.
And I think it was about taking down a video, not taking down a baby, right, Venkat? I heard you say that's baby takedown. So just wanted to make sure that people
right.
knew that wasn't, that's not like Section 512,
The baby killer. the baby killer section.
Yeah. This baby's going to be graduating junior high for sure by the time the case is resolved, maybe even high school.
Right. And before we go on, I mean, Venkat, you brought up bad lip reading, you know, that YouTube channel. That's hilarious. So I would commend anybody to go out and look at that. It's twitter.com/bad lip reading. And I know if you just do a search on YouTube for it, hilarious stuff. I just ran across that this past week, but there was some really funny stuff from like back in November from the debates, especially where I'm not going to go into the details of what it's all about, but just go and watch the one with the debate between Obama and Romney, where Jim Lehrer was the moderator. Hilarious stuff. And so I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's really, really funny and everybody should see it.
All right. Well, since we've got babies going down, we've got babies with back too. Jonathan Coulton, of course, did a wonderful, wonderful cover of Sir Mix-a-Lot's It, Babies Got Back. Sir Mix-a-Lot's Babies Got Back a few years back. If you have not enjoyed that particular rendition of the song, you must, because it is over and above one of the greatest cover songs ever made. In the strong tradition of white preppy kind of versions of rap songs. Apparently, though, Jonathan was sent a copy of a video, he was sent a video that contained a song done by the Glee cast of his particular arrangement of this song. So it raises, I think, some really interesting copyright issues. We were talking before the show that none of us really has a definitive answer or really definitive thoughts on the legalities of all this, because we're talking about a cover of a cover, essentially. But I think that the key to whether Jonathan has any remedy here, and the songs are identical, really, in their arrangement and their, again, I'm not a musician, but how they play out. Maybe we could play a bit of them, Alex. I put the links in there. If you could possibly cue those up while we're talking. There we go. I'm not sure if this is the Glee version or the Coulton version, because they sound so similar. And I cannot lie, you are the brothers, can't deny. When a girl walks in with an itty bitty, that's Coulton. Okay, let's hear a little Glee.
I feel so hipster sly right now. I'm just
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny.
Right down to using banjo or mandolin or whatever that is. As you listen through to the whole thing, they're just clearly they had listened to his song and were attempting to duplicate it. I don't think there can be much question about that. If we take that as a given, then what are Coulton's remedies? I mean, he's pretty ticked off about it. This was written up at Wired. Apparently he's investigating his legal rights. He thinks it was just sort of rude and wrong. Would have at least, liked to, buy your leave. But none of that was forthcoming. Jonathan Coulton is extraordinarily open with his works. Everything is available for digital download, and I think of any artist in the world you could pick to try and get permissions from, Coulton would be the guy who would be forthcoming and ready to work with you. But apparently none of that happened. So the question is, does he have a copyright to his precise arrangement of this song? None of us really know the answer to that question, it's an interesting one. I would think that even though he was doing a cover song himself, that his arrangement would receive protection. What do you think, Jason? I mean, all of us are kind of at sea on this.
Yeah, so I was thinking of it in terms of a Section 115 compulsory license, which is the cover license. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the cover license is that it doesn't seem to give rights in the arrangement you create. You explicitly give up rights as a derivative work. So a derivative work is a work where you take the previous work and you add something onto it. But when you get a Section 115 compulsory license, that you give up your derivative rights. So when I was thinking of it in those terms, I'm not sure that he's got rights in the derivative work, in the arrangement. He definitely mm-hmm. has rights in his performance, in his recording of his performance. So if they duplicated his performance in digital form, that would be copyright infringement. But I'm not clear that he has rights here in the arrangement that he did.
Yeah, I think it's a perplexing issue. Anybody want to add their two cents or just otherwise enjoy the musical interlude here, Venkat?
That's a tough one. I guess one question I have is, it's a cover. Is a cover where somebody performs another song, the words and the notes? I mean, it sort of seemed like a variation. It didn't sound the same as the Sir Mix-a-Lot version, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And I am curious as to whether that means it's a cover or is it something other than a cover. So that's a bad, poor answer. I'm also curious about the shaming aspect of it, kind of coming back to a point that Evan made early on. That is, you know, what is going to be the blowback for Glee, and are in the court of public opinion, are they going to take a beating, or is this just sort of net culture where something goes on in one sphere, but you know, it doesn't really affect the ratings of Glee or have any detrimental effect on it outside of any legal proceedings that Colton may pursue.
I would imagine there's not a whole lot of overlap. Maybe I'm wrong on this. Culture surprises us all the time, but there's not a whole lot of overlap between Colton fans and Glee watchers, you know, so, you know, maybe there's, you know, that would mitigate any risk that there's going to be too negative PR on this. This seems like a kind of a subculture of people who would actually care enough to, you know, make a kind of a negative conclusion about that. And I guess the other observation I would make is that this is a pretty good cover of Baby Got Back, but it's not nearly as good as the one from a few years ago that somebody did in the Gilbert and Sullivan style. I don't know if you remember that one. That was much better. So take a listen to that one if you get a chance. Again, just go to YouTube and do Baby Got Back Gilbert and Sullivan, and you
which
may
is
not
what I will be
afternoon.
Doing right after the show. And Alex has yep. done it.
There it is. You know, the Kevin Spacey appearance in the video is, or I'm sorry, yeah, is it Kevin Kline is in the video, so it's great.
There it is. All you other brothers can't deny. When a girl walks in with an itty-bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you
see what I mean? Wanna pull out there's Kevin Kline.
You notice that butt was stuffed deep in the jeans she's wearing. I'm hooked and I can't stop staring.
Okay, so Glee cannot have known about this, or they would have done the Gilbert and Sullivan version.
Wouldn't you think? A little bit more.
And everyone in the Venn diagram that you mentioned, Evan, of folks who would be familiar with both Glee and Jonathan Colton is either on this show, listens to the show, or listens to a network's worth of shows.
Right. There's a sweet spot.
Yes. And any music lawyers who are listening in should be sure and talk to Jonathan Colton, because he's got a complicated and interesting legal issue on his hands there. Let's move on, from Jonathan Colton to Joan Rivers. And Evan, I guess this is in your neck of the woods, and you wrote it up at your blog, internetcases.com. An interesting right of publicity case that was a documentary film about comedians, and it included a clip of some backstage footage, a conversation with Joan Rivers. It doesn't sound like it was very long. In fact, it comprised 0.3% of the entire documentary, but that didn't stop someone from suing on Joan Rivers' behalf and saying, hey, you are misappropriating Joan's name and likeness, and that's not okay. But the Seventh Circuit said it was. Have I got pretty much all that right?
Right, right. Yeah, there was a right of there was a privacy violation claim and a right of publicity, and those are kind of, you know, first maybe second cousins to one another. They kind of share a common ancestor in thinking, you know, back at least historically. And you know, when I saw this case come out, I guess it was last week now from the Seventh Circuit, I wondered whether or not to actually post about it because it's a little bit outside of the types of things that I write about on internetcases.com, which tracks, you know, legal developments with technology. But what's implicit in this and why I really decided to write about it is how it implicates some of the issues that we talk about with little brother. You know, we all have these cameras that we can go around filming each other doing things here. And what we had was a 16-second clip of a woman who was talking to Joan Rivers after a show, kind of siding with Joan Rivers, or at least consoling is not the right word, but saying, hey, yeah, that heckler was really doing you wrong during the show. And then Joan Rivers, they kind of had a conversation about that. The sum total of that being that this woman who appeared in this video having this conversation didn't really look all that good. It was sort of embarrassing for her to be making the comments that she was making here. So there's a couple of interesting things that you can extract from that, just the kind of the effect of us filming each other and having this stuff end up in context where you wouldn't necessarily think it likely to. In the end, there was no, as you observed, Denise, there was no invasion of privacy, mainly because the context didn't support a reasonable expectation of privacy on the part of this woman. And also no misappropriation of the right of publicity for a couple of reasons. One, there was what the court found to be a public interest exception to a claim that because the film was about kind of show business in general and Americans' obsession with comedy and show business, that this was akin to the newsworthiness exception to the right of publicity. And also something that appears to be analogous to de minimis use in a copyright infringement analysis, what the court called an incidental use exception under, and this was all under Wisconsin state law, you know, because it comprised 0.3%, almost 1/3 of 1% of the whole show. It was just such a little insignificant part of it. The court found that that there was no misappropriation of the right of publicity in this. So, a couple of interesting angles that one can take on this, even if you don't care all that much for Joan Rivers.
All right. Any thoughts, Jason, before we move on?
Not really. I mean, this when I read the write up, it seemed like a pretty straightforward limitation. Or the Seventh Circuit affirming the district court's dismissal of the claim on failure to state a claim ground. So right at the very beginning. So if we take anything from it, I think it's also the fact that look, this is a clearly out of bounds claim as opposed to just a disputable claim. This wasn't something that was decided after extensive findings of fact. This was just decided right at the beginning of the case. And so clearly this type of conduct, the Seventh Circuit is saying, is permissible, this type of recording.
Venkat, can you think of a reason why the outcome would have been different or should have been different?
Well, I think, I mean, I would echo what Evan said, which is that in this age of, you know, constant filming, perhaps there is a diminished expectation of privacy. And if a little blurb is used, then, you know, more and more people are not going to have cause to complain. And it's not going to be offensive to the reasonable person. And I also wonder about an overall trend of, you know, people seem to sue over little blurbs that appear in footage. And this isn't necessarily a legal rule, but that those suits just seem to rarely be successful. And there's a ton of them. And people always seem to lose those suits, whether they're based on trademark or, as in this case, in right of publicity. But it seems like every month or so, we're always seeing a lawsuit where somebody says, oh, this little blip, you know, whether it's in a movie or a documentary, is somehow infringes. And that's always seems like a long shot to me.
You know, one thing that could be going on with us here culturally is that we are becoming more aware of an expectation that, or at least a hope or an aspiration that content we generate or content in which we are featured will be given its appropriate context. And that's different than a right of privacy. We've talked about that a lot in the context of social media and what you you hope will not show up. You hope that certain photos of yourself will not show up tagged on Facebook because you kind of expect your friends to keep that stuff in the right context. And the courts won't recognize it necessarily as an interest in privacy, but we, I think, normatively hope and expect, and I think we have become accustomed to it historically, that when you disclose certain information or do something or allow yourself to be photographed in a certain way, that people will generally respect that. But that is technology kind of disrupts that normative approach because we can so easily share content metaphorically or hyperbolically stated, share it with the whole world.
Evan, I have a couple of questions for you about this before we move on. First off, in the facts of the case, was the person recording Joan Rivers standing there with a microphone and a camera person such that it was obvious that this was being captured, or were they just having a conversation and someone happened to be nearby with a camera and a microphone?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a distinction there, but what I gather mm-hmm. is that it was not surreptitious. Mm-hmm. So I see what's implicit in your question there. If it had been mm-hmm. like lights and a camera and everything like that, her expectation, whether that be of privacy or expectation and that the content will be put in its appropriate context, that would affect that.
Right.
But what was critical in the analysis for the right of publicity claim was that she knew that she was not in a private place like a dressing room. The court actually talked about this. This would have come out different if this had been in Joan Rivers' dressing room, but this was in the hallway and there was the mm-hmm. din of chatter in the background. So there were people everywhere. So it's not like this was that anybody would think that this was something that couldn't be public in the most general sense.
Okay, and wait, one more question, and then Venkat, and then we'll move on. Let me back up for a second. You know how in many movies there will be a clip of a celebrity, they'll do sort of a cameo, and it'll be a real clip from the news or an interview or something, and it'll become part of the greater story of a movie, a fictional film. So you see examples of that happening all the time, and I'm pretty sure that nobody's going to do that without getting express permission.
Seems like you see Bill O'Reilly and Nancy Grace a lot in contexts
right.
like that.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Was the role of this movie as a documentary important to the outcome?
I think so, because that had to go with this exception under the an exception to what is protectable as a right of publicity in this person. Like I was saying, it was analogous to the newsworthiness portion mm-hmm. of it. It countenanced in terms of the public interest because it was actually more than just about Joan Rivers. It was about America's interest in this this genre and this activity, and even to go so broadly as to be about show business in general. So that played into whether or not this was a misappropriation of the right of publicity for that reason.
Got it. Fire away, Venkat.
And your question was great. I think it kind of raised the issue of, you know, was the recording with an iPhone or a video camera? And it reminds me of the inauguration footage that we saw. And virtually in every single photo or footage, there were like, you know, 50 people or 100 people taking pictures with their iPhones. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's a different scenario. It's a public event involving a public official. But I wonder in this day and age how likely it is that, you know, when a celebrity's around, there's not, you know, three or four people just sitting around taking photos or maybe even recording footage of what's going on. And it kind of raises the question of whether the result would have been different if the footage of Joan Rivers had appeared in somebody else's documentary and she was the one complaining, saying, hey, don't use my photo, and whether, you know, as a celebrity, she might have a different standard or an easier time asserting a right of publicity claim or a misappropriation claim. But I thought your question in general was great, Denise, that how the recording...
Yeah, and it goes to what Evan is saying about people understanding the context. Well, from Baby Got Back to backing tracks and the inauguration, as Venkat mentioned. And before we get to that, I do want to drop in our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you are listening for credit, either in the legal profession or some other, you can go to our wiki, Google twit.tv wiki, and you'll find information there about MCLE. Also, you can go to our show page at twit.tv/twill, T-W-I-L. And for all of you who are needing to demonstrate that you've actually listened to the show in order to get credit, I don't know how I can resist having you tell your state bar or other professional certification entity that Baby Got Back is the first passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Let's move on to Beyonce and the Marine Band and her rendition of the Star Spangled Banner, which was quite wonderful and moving, I thought. I'm getting this from Mike Masnick over at Tech Dirt, who in turn is highlighting the fact that the folks at Muck Rock filed a Freedom of Information request to find out if the backing track recorded by the Marine Band of the music for the Star Spangled Banner is in the public domain, because it is a creative work made by the federal government, and all things created by the federal government are supposed to be in the public domain. So they're going to find that out. We don't know the answer exactly. And I'm not even sure, nor was Mike, that a Freedom of Information Act request can target this kind of thing, but it'll be interesting to see what they get out of it. Venkat, did you have any thoughts about this?
Well, it's my understanding of the rule from reading Mike's post. It was that the U.S. government can't hold a copyright in materials that it creates, but it's not precluded from getting a copyright by assignment or through other means. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question is, if the Marine Band is an arm of the U.S. government and it performed the backing track, does that mean that it's produced by the U.S. government and it's in the public domain or not? And as with the last music question, I will throw my hands up in the air on that one. I mean, is the right way to look at it that the individual employees assign their copyright? Or, I mean, I'm kind of confounded as to when the U.S. government actually produces something versus when it acquires the copyrights in something by assignment, whether that's through employees or through other means. So to me, that would probably be a big question, and I'm very curious to see the results of the FOIA request that initially I thought almost sounded kind of frivolous to me, but now that I see it in the context of this ownership issue, is much more interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. And we're either persuading people to come into the thicket that is technology and or entertainment law, or we're making them run for the hills. I'm not sure which. Evan, what did you think of this?
I don't see what the big controversy is. I mean, this should be clearly a work of the federal government. And I don't think that the members of the Marine Corps Band are independent contractors. I think that they're, you know, they are certainly acting under the authority and within the scope of what the U.S. government wants them to do. So I think clearly the copyright ownership, if there were any, would attach to the government under the work made for hire doctrine. So we wouldn't have to worry about that step of whether there was an assignment. The second point I would make is I don't understand what FOIA has to do with this at all and what the guy who's sending the FOIA request really hopes to accomplish. So what if you get it back and they say no? What are you going to do? File a declaratory judgment action? Okay, fine. Masnick correctly put this in the too much time on your hands category if you read the post on Tech Dirt.
Yes.
The third point, I guess, is I would take issue with something that Mike Masnick said, and that is that Beyonce could arguably own the copyright in her portion of the performance. I don't see that at all. She was just a performer. She didn't do anything to reduce it to a tangible medium of expression. So she may have, hearkening back to our previous topic, some right of publicity interest in her performance that would keep somebody else from using a video clip or the recording of this, but I don't see how she could claim any copyright ownership in what it is that she was doing there. So again, it's fun to talk about this, and it's interesting, and you know, kind of different issues converge in one spot, but in the end, I don't see what's all that controversial about it.
Jason, was this intriguing to you?
A little bit. I wonder whether now we're going to see lots of people filing FOIA requests to get free music, right? They can't download it through the internet, so they're going to get lots of free Marine Corps band music, and that's going to be the next wave of free music.
Yeah. Well, once again, a very small universe of people is interested in that music, but I'm sure are a passionate group.
It reminds me of the Onion article. It's like 90-year-old guy who swore that he has a legal right to torrent, and it was like some, you know, song from big band, you know, from the 20s or 30s. I forget. You know? And yeah, I should practice my delivery, but it's just like, yeah, there's a pretty small subset there. And, you know, that's not what piracy is all about.
All right. Well, moving from small subsets to large subsets, everyone at some point or another, and we're taking a break here. If anyone needs to get coffee or excuse themselves, now would be a good time, because we're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. And the large subset of folks I was referring to are those who have legal concerns in either their business or personal lives. In fact, if you've been waiting for the perfect time to start your dream business, it's right now, because you can incorporate your business or form an LLC at LegalZoom starting at just not even $199. That would be cheap. This is starting at $99. Forming your business the right way can save you money on taxes and ensure that your personal assets are legally protected. LegalZoom can also help with trademarks, copyrights, patents, NDAs, and lots more. If you have a family, guess what? You need to make sure they're protected too. You can protect your family and assets with a LegalZoom will for just $69 or establish a living trust. If you don't have a will, you leave it up to the government and courts to decide what happens to your family's assets, and that's never the best solution. In the past 12 years, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom for LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more. If you have questions or need legal advice, you can even access an extensive network of attorneys through LegalZoom's legal plans available in most states. You can search online profiles and unedited customer reviews to work with a LegalZoom plan attorney who's right for you and your business. So start your business and protect your family today at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm. You can get self-help services at your specific direction, or you can speak to a legal plan attorney and get your questions answered and get ongoing advice. To receive a special thank you for using LegalZoom through TWIT, make sure you enter the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, in the referral box at checkout. You'll get $10 off. So thank you so much, LegalZoom.com, for your support of This Week in Law. And everyone, head on over to LegalZoom and use the offer code TWIL. Just as an aside, when I was getting ready for the show and pulling up the Glee version of the Sir Mix-a-Lot song, the ad that was attached to that was a LegalZoom ad, so that was appropriate. Let's move on and talk about some more general copyright stories. So we were talking about photos earlier and context and how the things that you're sharing online may get used down the road. There was an interesting decision, Venkat, that you wrote up at Eric Goldman's technology and marketing blog that definitively decided that no, AFP may not just pluck photos off of Twitter and use them freely. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So it was a fun case that I enjoyed following. I think every blogger has a case that sometimes they latch onto, and this was one that fit in that category for me. But the basic dispute involved these photos of the Haiti earthquake that were taken by a photographer in Haiti, and he posted them to Twitter and TwitPic, and somebody else, also in Haiti, posted the same photos to his Twitter and TwitPic account. So a second person posted them to the Twitter account, and AFP came along and was looking for photos, and in the heat of the moment talked to the second person who was not the owner of the photos, took the photos, and then they ended up downstream, went to Getty, went to Washington Post, and they were widely distributed. And AFP basically started issuing, or the photographer Morrell started issuing takedowns, and AFP filed a peremptory lawsuit in the Southern District of New York saying that they did not infringe. And the photographer asserted a bunch of counterclaims. So the AFP made this argument that because the photos were uploaded to Twitter, then it was entitled to freely distribute the photos, and it was a third-party beneficiary of the Twitter terms of service or the TwitPic terms of service. And the court said, no, that's not the correct interpretation. Twitter does have a broad license to any content that's uploaded to its service, but that just means that Twitter and potentially third parties are entitled to use content, whether that's photographs or tweets, within the ecosystem. So if you retweet somebody else's tweet and that contains a photo, that retweet is what is encompassed by Twitter's broad license. Twitter's license does not mean that a third party could come along, download the photos, and then, you know, stick them in its magazine and now claim the benefit of this broad terms of license that is included in Twitter's agreement. So that was one part of the dispute. There's also actually kind of a second part of the dispute that relates to whether Getty was entitled to DMCA protection that was super interesting in its own right. But I think the kind of fun social media aspect of the dispute was whether or not a third party could come along and just take photos and claim the benefit of a license agreement, such as a Twitter's license agreement.
Let's understand the Getty issue, because I do think that is a fascinating one. So they have material on their site that they think that they have the license to, but they do not. And the outcome here was that they did not have DMCA protection. Is that right?
That's right. And yeah, the court looked at it. So Getty, in this context, Getty basically took in photos from different places and then licensed it out to third parties. So Getty's mm-hmm. customers could log on to Getty's system and find and search for photos similar to, say, a Shutterstock or one of these stock photos. And third parties could get these photos. And Getty said, hey, we are an automated service that, you know, takes in content at the direction of our inbound licensees, and so we're entitled to DMCA protection. And the court said no. And there were two parts to the court's ruling. One part was that Getty was actively involved in licensing the content. So the court said, you know, DMCA protection is typically reserved for intermediaries, and Getty is not a pure intermediary because Getty's salespeople or whomever were kind of selling the content and encouraging third parties to download the content. And then the other part of the court's DMCA ruling, which I found kind of interesting, was the court said to be entitled to DMCA protection, you have to perform some sort of service. You can't just be the sort of licensing engine and claim DMCA protection. That's kind of what I distilled out of the court's language. And I thought that was curious because mm-hmm. really any other entity that claims DMCA protection is in the same boat. I mean, YouTube, right, all it does is take in content, make it available to third parties. Sure, it may not charge a licensing fee, but that, you know, the fact that it's really a distribution mechanism and that's all it is does not deprive YouTube of DMCA protection. But in this case, for some reason, the court kind of intimated that Getty was not entitled to DMCA protection because that's all it does is just kind of take in content and license it out to third parties.
And probably everyone who uploads their inbound licensees, as you said, they have to agree to terms of service that represent to Getty that, yes, they have the rights to put them on Getty images and sub-license them from there. So you would think that would give Getty some protection, but apparently not.
Nope.
All right. So I thought this was pretty interesting. I thought it was just outrageous that the AFP would take the position that they could pluck photos off of Twitter and use them without compensation or a license other than what was in Twitter's terms of service. And you expressed that opinion at the end of your write-up too, Venkat. Evan, any other thoughts about this?
Well, just what you were saying right there, it was just kind of rude, not a good business model, it would seem, that the AFP was putting itself into. And I guess just to go back a little bit, that what we were talking about with the court's unwillingness to extend DMCA protection to platforms that don't provide a service, that seems like a really, it seems like perhaps a slippery slope. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm having a hard time articulating what the problem with that is, but it's obviously a problem, because where do you draw the line as to what constitutes a service that should be entitled to DMCA protection? I mean, yes, there's the definition in Section 512 of what an online service provider is, but there's little help in figuring out the nature and the extent of those services, because if you look at it at a certain level, they're all the same of providing the, transcoding display. Maybe there's something additional in YouTube because it provides advertising opportunities and stuff like that. But yeah, that could be really problematic and lead to some litigation on this issue that should otherwise it generally has been pretty clear cut whether a platform is entitled to that type of protection as a service, online service provider under the DMCA. But this could kind of poke a hole in that and create some problems.
Yeah, Jason, that's always been kind of both a bug and a feature of the DMCA, hasn't it? That it has such a broad definition of what an online service provider is or is not.
Yes, it definitely allows a lot of conduct that might not be legal absent the safe harbor, the service provider protection, to take place. Mm-hmm. What I actually found most interesting here is the degree of protection that we give to images versus text. And you see texts retweeted going up on television all the time, not really that much of a concern about it. Photographs are different. Images are treated differently, maybe because there's so much more information being conveyed by them, maybe perhaps because there's no attribution here, the correct attribution wasn't actually used. But I think even if the correct attribution had been used, there still would be a copyright claim here. So I really find that distinction that we treat texts and images very, very differently to be interesting here. That was an interesting sub-theme going on here.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And we've talked a lot previously on the show about the copyrightability of tweets. And I think basically come down, Evan, haven't we, that it depends on the tweet, that just the brevity is not enough to say that you could never have a copyright in a tweet. And I saw an interesting article, I think someone shot it my way this week, about what is a tweet and the changing nature of tweets and how when they are... now that you can see, blurbs of what's being linked to and the image, if that is also linked to, so tweets now are not just 140 characters. As you look at them, you see a lot more visually going on. And does that affect their copyrightability? Along with, too, the new feature that they introduced this week, Vine, small 6-second video clips that are going to be, the video analog of text tweets. So the Twitterverse and copyright law it continues to get more and more complex. Any final thoughts on this before we move on, Venkat?
I agree. It's super interesting. And the fact that you can embed a tweet, and if somebody uploads a photo to a tweet using Twitter's native app, I can turn around and embed it in my blog post. And I think it kind of raises the question of, you're still using it within the ecosystem, but you could achieve pretty broad distribution of content through Twitter itself. So I think it'll continue to get interesting.
Right. I'm going to give a talk at a local law school here in Southern California soon on the topic of how IP law curriculum should change or what it should include to take into account relatively recent, and in legal terms, that means within the last 20 years, changes in technology. So this is definitely going to be in that panel's discussion, I think. Anybody else want to weigh in before we move on?
I would just be making it up.
All right. We were talking about earlier, how the DMCA takedown process works and how it may not be a problem with the law. It's more a problem with implementation and practicality. I think that's true, too, of the complaint by Joshua Topolsky that their material from The Verge is being scraped by the Huffington Post, which is using, you know, a bit of the article with a link back to The Verge. And the problem here, again, this is written up by Mike Masnick at TechDirt. The problem seems to be not so much that there's an infringement going on as The Verge is not happy with the way that search deals with this, that, you know, the Huffington Post gets the SEO benefit as opposed to The Verge. And just as a footnote, Mike Masnick says, please, please, and he titles his post here, "Dear HuffPo, feel free to send traffic to TechDirt," because you send a lot of traffic when you do this. An ongoing, and I think, again, you know, this is one of those how IP law curriculum needs to address what's happening. This happens all the time. You know, Huffington Post is not the only offender, although they are a high profile one. So, Jason, you know, as you're conversing with law students about this, who are going to go out and start businesses that are going to aggregate web content, how do you tell them to navigate these waters?
And this is a hard one. We were actually discussing a really similar situation in my intro class just 2 days ago. It's an ongoing problem. How do you deal with the concept of aggregators, of news aggregators, when there's not any copyright infringement taking place, or arguably no copyright infringement taking place, and yet some element of their hard work, of the actual creator, the first creator's hard work, is being taken? How do you deal with that? There's an old concept called the tort of misappropriation that often was used to apply to hot news. It still comes up in some cases that tries to get at it, but it's a doctrine that's been fairly limited. It's hard to have a good cause of action here, a good legal claim. And I'm not sure that's wrong. I actually think that from our normative perspective, that's the way we should – some element of free writing is going to be acceptable. Some element of free writing is going to be good. And here, the bloggers are getting a benefit. They're actually they get something in return. They get some traffic. Maybe they're not at the top of the search results, but maybe not everyone goes to the search results to actually get their news. They go to a news aggregator and then follow the links through to the blog post. So I'm not sure that there's anything fundamentally wrong here, and I'm not sure that the bloggers themselves aren't getting something of value in return for having their news scraped by the HuffPo.
And SEO is such an imprecise science. I mean, nobody except the mind of Google really knows how Google works. And you wonder if, just because this turn, you know, the results for the death of the arcade, now the Huffington Post, Adriana's site, comes up higher than The Verge just for this one thing. I mean, does that necessarily mean there's bad SEO stuff going on here? Because I think it'd be pretty healthy for The Verge's page rank to have a lot of traffic on a continual basis coming from HuffingtonPost.com over there. You know, who knows if in the end it's really going to be harmful from an SEO standpoint. I have a feeling, I would consider that we certainly are friends of The Verge, given our the fact that we've had Nilay Patel on the show so many times. But I don't know Josh Topolsky, but you wonder if there's a little bit of you know, I don't even know what the word is. You know, just kind of a little bit of upsetness about this. And so he put this tweet out. Maybe there wasn't a whole lot of deliberation in on his part that went on here. And I'm just saying this because I found myself in the same situation where I have seen people copying my content from my blog. And my first impulse sometime is to be a copyright maximalist and think, my God, I'm going to take this SOB to court and get my $750 minimum statutory damage. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, I'm calmed down a little bit. I don't know. I'm probably revealing just more about my own psychology than anything else in making these comments.
Well, Joshua Topolsky's tweet reads like a modern day demand letter. Formal public request. Please remove the content you've scraped from us. Seriously. You know, what more do you need?
I always end every cease and desist letter I write with a
seriously.
And
just adds a little something. Venkat, what do you think?
You're supposed to end the letter with "govern yourself accordingly." That's the appropriate terminology, Evan.
But, wrong gentleman, yeah.
Yes. You know, this is a great question. I mean, it kind of harkens back to the RSS dispute. And was it the Pulse Reader? I forgot the name of the reader, the iPad reader that was kind of, you know,
or scraping. Flipboard,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't have a good answer. I think that the Huffington Post probably leaves somewhat of a bad taste in everyone's mouth just because it's such a random repository of content, and, you know, it's viewed for better or worse as just like the slideshow farm or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, it's a successful business that generates a lot of traffic and advertising, and maybe there's some element of, hey, I'm a journalist. I'm working hard to produce my content, and here's somebody else that is profiting, you know, just profiting, but doesn't have great content. And I think that's got to leave a bad taste in everyone's mouth. They've never scraped my headlines, but I know I would have a very similar reaction. I don't have a good solution to the problem. To the question of, you know, whether it's appropriate or whether the law should step in. I think I would agree that, you know, we have to tolerate some amount of scraping.
What do you think of Mike's assertion that it's up to Google to fix this? That, you know, you can't just give more juice to an aggregator than the originating site.
I like that, but I think there's no, I mean, it's just a suggestion is all it is, right? I don't, mm-hmm. I think like Evan said, SEO is notoriously murky. And Google's constantly tinkering, and we'll never know one way or the other because I think just the innards of SEO are so hard to. We're never going to get the answer of how it plays out, and I think it's going to be very tough to influence. In a perfect world, I do agree Google should fix it, but you know, I don't know that they're ever going to or ever going to be forced into doing anything about it.
They're too busy responding to all these DMCA takedown notices. They'll never do anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, Evan. Well, we've been talking about, you know, for a while we were talking about the 3 strikes plan. Now the 6 strikes plan is actually starting to be ready for implementation by various ISPs, and lots of leaks of internal documents toward this end have been coming out on Torrent Freak. And once again, Mike Masnick has written up the a few of them, aggregated a few of them, if you will, from Verizon and AT&T, and I think Time Warner is in here, showing us the contours of how some of these things will be implemented. And again, you know, all of this is leak and rumor, and nothing is set in stone yet, but these appear to be legitimate documents leaked by the ISPs as to how they're going to tell people, their customers, how the alerts are going to work under the 6 strikes program. There are a couple of concerns. I mean, they're mostly just annoyance value, right? You're going to get some notices, and then you're going to either be slowed to a crawl of 256K for browsing. And I thought it was funny that I think this is the Verizon leaked document that says You can choose for that crawl. It's going to be 2 or 3 days in length. You're going to have to, this is on your fifth and sixth alert, you can slow down to 256K either immediately, or you can postpone that for 14 days, you know, if you're really busy and you need to have speed. But you're going to have to do the time at some point. But the big concern too is a statement that customers are responsible for their high-speed internet connection. Again, here I'm reading from the AT&T leaked document. Even if they did not personally download any content themselves, the terms of service makes you responsible. So Mike is very concerned that folks who provide Wi-Fi, coffee shops or anyone else, you know, library, think of all the places where public Wi-Fi is available, and that one of these carriers might be your ISP, that they would be on the hook for illegal activity going on their connection. So now that we're starting to see what this looks like, Evan, do you think that it is shaping up nicely, or do you have any concerns?
Well, it's shaping up, I guess, the way we would have expected it to. There were a couple of things that I was prompted to look into. I haven't looked into them yet, so, you know, I'll get to that on item number 967 on my list. But was, you know, I mean, do these things apply to commercial accounts, which would get to the Wi-Fi, public Wi-Fi question, you know, the Starbucks local coffee shop? Because, you know, certainly they're wanting to deal with individual piracy or piracy by individuals taking place at 2:30 in the morning. That's at least the image that I have in my mind of the, you know, the typical piracy that happens. Maybe it's not 2:30 in the morning, but 2:30 in the afternoon too. So I wonder about that. And then I was also, I mean, I'm a little bit concerned about this review process. This, you pay $35 to have the AAA, the American Arbitration Association, look at the validity of your, of the alerts that you were given.
Tell me what you think the American Arbitration is going to do for you for $35.
Right. I mean, that is just... I mean, that's going to just barely cover the cost of getting the file delivered to somebody's desk, you know, to look at. So I think that there's a tremendous potential for abuse there. I would find it really hard to believe that there will ever be anything meaningful that will happen from that review. And you can just tell from, like we're talking about here, the economics of it, there's not going to be any kind of substantive evaluation as to whether or not any infringement took place, which is really what your defense will – you know, your best defense would be if these alerts were wrong. It's only, I have a feeling, and based upon the language here, because it says you can ask for a review of the validity of your alerts. So does that only mean, you know, were you given, you know, were you given the say the right thing in the language? It's just like, it seems like there's a really meaningless opportunity for remedy here, or, you know, the only opportunity is for something meaningless, I guess, is the right thing to say. Right. And you're just going to be throwing your $35 away, it sounds, lining the pockets.
And while I'm belittling the amount as far as what substance you might get out of the AAA, for the AAA, what a boon. I mean, you know, they're going to be churning out these sort of, okay, you know, yes, they saw this activity, they sent you this alert, blah, blah, blah. They're going to be raking in those $35 fees. They've got to love that. Sure. Jason?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the $35 fee. I mean, if it only costs $35 to file a dispute, might have thousands of these things filed, and it's going to cost a lot more than $35 to do that work, I would suspect. Maybe even cutting and pasting. It's going to take more than 15 or 20 minutes to write up the response. So I'm not sure about the $35. That seems like an awfully low fee to charge for an arbitration proceeding.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious about two things. One is the mechanism by which they're generating these reports. As Evan alluded to, that's kind of the meat of it. What they do with it is one thing, and they could have a zero or one strike plan. But how they're generating these reports is, to me, the really important issue. And I also wonder how serious they can be about using this mechanism, because if they cast too wide of a net, they're going to cut off a large portion of their customers. I mean, if every coffee shop is now going to have its Wi-Fi basically shut off because of this mechanism, well, that's could potentially be a serious cost to the service providers. I mean, now they're not going to have any businesses providing Wi-Fi. That's going to affect their bottom line as well. So I wonder how serious they are about implementing this on a really broad scale, and also about how they're going to, the mechanisms they're going to use to generate these reports.
Yeah, that point that you raised, Evan, whether it's going to apply to commercial accounts is a really important one and isn't clear from what I'm looking at here. It may, if it doesn't apply to commercial accounts, I could see, you know, a mad rush to people creating their home account as a business one, as I have done here at my home because I work out of my home. So Venkat, any other thoughts on this?
I was traveling recently. This is sort of off topic, but mm-hmm. and I was subject to some sort of weird filtering mechanism where it was in Europe, and it was a combination of filtering and I think throttling, and it was a huge bummer as far as your overall internet experience. And I just thought I'd mention that. Yeah. I think that this is part of an overall trend towards sort of private dispute resolution, whether that's, you know, in the courts of YouTube having to deal with the takedown, or this is kind of in the same genre. And I'm very curious, maybe I missed the boat on this, but I'm really curious about litigation around this, because this sounds like there are possibilities. I mean, I got to see somebody challenging this somehow. And maybe it's easier said than done, but I think my instinct tells me there's a lot, this is ripe for litigation.
Right. We'll have to see when they actually roll them out. I'm sure there will be, you know, any number of attempted challenges. So stay tuned for those. And let's go ahead and make our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, six strikes. That should be easy to remember. And let's also thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile. As has been really clear from what we've been talking about today, we work today very differently from the way we did years ago. Communicating, collaborating, and interfacing with clients and coworkers is essential now, and that's why thousands of people rely on ShareFile by Citrix. ShareFile makes working with others easy while keeping important work files secure and under your control. With ShareFile, you can easily share email sizes, files of almost any size. In other words, you don't have to worry about how you're going to get this file to your client. You're going to use a technology that they're already very familiar and comfortable with, and that's their email. But yet you're not going to have to worry about how big your file is, because everything's going to get delivered quickly and securely. You're going to get notifications when those files were received and opened, and you can transfer files to others confidentially. You decide who has access, and there's password protection to ensure the highest security. Plus, post project related files to a shared collaboration space. So if you need to be working together on something, you easily have a space to do that. And ShareFile allows you to access your files from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, or your smartphone. So it serves all kinds of different functions. It gets your file there safely. It lets you collaborate. It lets you use your laptop or tablet or smartphone as a remote office and gets you to all of that material that you've shared there. For someone like me, I am my own small business. This kind of tool is just invaluable. ShareFile is my extranet for clients. It's how I make sure that they get the large media files that I periodically have to send them. It's how I make sure that opposing counsel has actually received and read something that I need them to receive and read. Or if they haven't, then I have that in my back pocket too. It's a really, really wonderful tool, and I want you to try it today. You can sign up with my special offer. You get a full 30 days for free. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in TWIL. Thank you, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. Let's go back to the Seventh Circuit and another interesting decision out of there recently. And that has to do with whether or not sex offenders can be banned from using social media. Initially, a court said, yes, that was okay. The Seventh Circuit has come in and said, nope, sorry, that's unconstitutionally broad. These people have free speech rights too. Evan, have you taken a look at this?
I did, and I think the decision makes sense. And, you know, this the larger moral of the story to learn from this decision is, I think we should be grateful that that we have a tripartite government, one of which is comprised of judges that are appointed for life, and you can't fire them, and they're not subject to the political whims, ostensibly, you know, in a pure sense here, if they're, you know, if it works out the way it's supposed to. Because, you know, how toxic is the idea of how you treat sex offenders? And if you even begin to sound like you're going to stand up for them or any rights, then public opinion can easily turn against you, and you can be carted off and, you know, never to be heard from again in a public forum. But the judges here, despite the fact that there was a very toxic subject matter coming up here, namely the rights, the First Amendment rights that people who do sexual things to children have, you know, even though that was the issue, they came to what I think was the correct decision under the First Amendment. At issue was whether or not it was against, it was a violation of these people's First Amendment rights to be banned from social networks. And the Indiana had enacted a law, and then the district court said, yeah, that law is fine. But it went up to the Seventh Circuit and says that that law is too broad. It does more than what is necessary to deal with this, yes, this compelling government interest of protecting people from sex offenders. But the law wasn't narrowly tailored to do that. And, you know, it's not hard to think of situations where a sex offender would have a non-sex offending way to use social media. You know, maybe they have been seen the light and redeemed, and they want to get on Facebook to communicate with the members of their church group, right? I'm just, you know, thinking of some. All you have to do is just come up with some example of a way that this restriction is too broad, and that makes it a violation of the Fourth Amendment, because therefore it's not narrowly tailored to meet this. Yes, it's a compelling government interest, but it's still got to be narrowly tailored. It goes to show how important our First Amendment rights are in this country, our interest in free speech. And, you know, I think the court came to the right decision here.
Okay. Venkat, I guess this kind of relates to, well, first of all, tell me, were you surprised by this at all? Do you think that that there might be a move at any state level to continue going forward and limiting the access of criminals in general to social networks? Or are they going to get the message here?
I think state legislatures will continue to try to tinker in this area. Mm-hmm. And as the Ars article noted, recently California enacted a statute somewhat similar, but a court issued an injunction enjoining enforcement of that statute. And I think also last year, Nebraska also had a sex offender statute that a district court struck down with some pretty harsh words to the legislature. So to answer your question, I think legislatures will continue to try to tinker in this area. And as Evan pointed out, you know, it's good that courts are recognizing that, you know, just because somebody's a sex offender, they don't lose all First Amendment rights, and they could use the internet in a productive way, at least, you know, a chunk of the time.
Right. One of the things the Seventh Circuit panel wrote was that illicit communication comprises a minuscule subset of the universe of social networking activity. As such, this law targets substantially more activity than the evil it seeks to redress. Professor Rantanen, any thoughts here? Do you agree that there's a constitutional issue?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the Seventh Circuit panel got it right here, both in the result and in the way it achieved that result. It recognized that there is some flexibility for states to pass laws that do restrict rights of speech, but here it was just so extreme. It was such a disproportionate response that it simply couldn't pass constitutional muster. And you could pass a law that says that sex offenders can't speak at all, and then, you know, you could deal with the problem that way. But that would, again, be such a disproportionate response. And I think the court saw what was going on here basically is essentially the same thing, or is of that really broad scope. But it left open the door for states to pass narrower laws, to think about the issue, to tinker with it some more.
Well, go ahead, Evan.
Well, I was just going to say, how do you think you could draft a statute that would narrowly address this situation? And I'm not asking it like to be incredulous, thinking that you couldn't. I'm just kind of curious of how one would go about it. I think it could be done.
Do we still have Jason?
Jump in. No, I'm still here. I thought someone else was about to jump in. Yeah, I think you see how could you draft it this way?
Well, California tried.
Yeah, so California, I think what the California statute says is that you have to indicate that you're a registered sex offender when you sign up for one of these services, when you sign up for a social networking service. So you have to basically kind of wear your scarlet letter on your chest so that everyone knows who you are. That would certainly be closer to the constitutional line. I'm not sure that it necessarily satisfies the constitutional line, though. Because it is essentially that scarlet letter, and you may be in circumstances, professional business circumstances, where you don't need to wear your scarlet letter all the time. Perhaps a statute that limited to particular types of speech, to communication specifically with minors, so that was not so broad as to encompass all speech on a social networking site, but was more directed towards speech specifically with minors. I think the court used that as an example of something that would be closer to the line than this example here, that would be more potentially constitutionally permissible. So I think there are options here. It's not that you just have to have a blanket ban on all social networking. I think that is look, we've got a problem, so here we're going to take the quickest, easiest solution to it. We're just going to write a really broad law, and that'll deal with the problem. Nope, now we're all set. We've washed our hands of the problem. It's not an issue anymore. I think that's what the court was concerned happened here.
Right, and Venkat, you pointed out Prop 35. Was this portion of the law, you said part of it was put on hold. It passed last November, and it contained a provision that required certain folks, registered sex offenders, to notify local law enforcement every time they signed up for a new internet service or acquired a new internet identifier, electronic mail address, username, screen name, similar identifier, used for the purpose of forum discussions, chat, et cetera, social networking. They would have to, you know, keep a list and keep updating that list with local law enforcement. Is that no longer in effect?
I believe that was enjoined pending resolution of the lawsuit. And a big challenge is that there was no assurance that law enforcement would disclose the identity, the real identity of the registrants in a narrow set of circumstances. It sort of was wishy-washy about when law enforcement could disclose somebody's identity to the public. And that was very problematic. And the court said, you know, that's really at odds with this right to engage in anonymous speech. So I think that's going to be a challenge, is sort of reconciling a registrant's right to engage in harmless, anonymous political speech with what are viewed as harmful online activities. So I don't have a good solution. And I think one possibility might be to restrict the applicability of the statute to people who engaged in sex offenses using the internet or online, or who somehow face a higher risk of reoffending through the online channel. I think that narrow subset of people may be subject to higher regulation. I could see a court maybe tolerating increased regulation of that narrow subset of individuals, but I think these three decisions leave it kind of open as to how things are going to pan out.
Well, it's a weird issue because on the one hand, you don't want to give registered sex offenders the opportunity to commit more crimes that they, you know, may be inclined to commit. But at the same time, social media sure is a great place to gather evidence about crimes being committed. And along those lines, let's think about privacy for a moment. So Venkat, you did a nice January roundup of recent social media evidence cases and who was getting access to social media accounts in litigation and who was not. Seemed like most of these were civil litigation between private parties and the government wasn't involved. Am I right about that?
That's right. They were mostly employment or personal injury cases, I think, were the two categories of cases.
Okay. So per your post, which has a great graphic, by the way, I love the little monster faces on your post. What does that come from?
Well, that's funny you say that, because we get images from Shutterstock and elsewhere, mm-hmm. but I'm always joking with Eric about the selection of images and how I put a lot of care into picking the right image. So I'm really glad to hear you say that.
Yes, this very nicely visually demonstrates the state of the law, which is kind of all over the map.
Exactly. And I think the fundamental challenge is, you know, courts all acknowledge that people record stuff online that's probative and indicative of how they feel and what's going on. And courts also recognize that just because something is online does not mean it's off limits, in the same way that if you recorded something in your diary, theoretically your opposing party who knew about it could get access to it. I think the fundamental challenge is kind of drawing a line and saying, you know, what are we going to require somebody to show before giving them access to an account? And then once, assuming somebody is entitled to access an account, how are we going to kind of circumscribe their access so they're not rummaging around and getting access to information that they may not otherwise, or that they shouldn't be entitled to? So I think I've made this point before, that this scenario presents logistical challenges because the party who's seeking the information can't know what's in the account and often just has a tough time making the case, and they're kind of hamstrung. The flip side is that, you know, the people whose accounts are at issue shouldn't have to sort of open up their accounts freely to opposing parties.
All right. So we're talking about parties in litigation, kind of a related issue, but not exactly the same by any means, is what happens to somebody's information once they are gone. And we have this example of a model in England who fell from a 12th floor balcony. Her parents suspect foul play from her. It's difficult to tell. She was married to a person, but in a ceremony that wasn't recognized under the law in England. Anyway, the parents want to investigate, and they have been trying to get information from various social media accounts and haven't been having much success. They want to, you know, give the prosecutor some ammunition to, you know, investigate foul play. Unfortunately, that's not working out for them. Do you think that courts are going to view this kind of case differently?
I think so. And it also probably depends on the network in question. And my recollection in this particular case was that Facebook took the position that they didn't want to disclose the information absent a court order. And I think they said that there's no sort of waiver provision in the Stored Communications Act, and there wasn't a clear path to allowing the executor of the estate to take over the social media account and consent mm-hmm. to disclosure. That's my recollection of how the case resolved. And so given that, I think courts will continue to be hesitant, and I think there's going to be a lot of gray area about who gets to access online accounts in the event of somebody's death or even disability for that matter.
Right. And then just to throw another wrinkle on this, you know, who gets what access to people's social media accounts. Google publicly announced that more than 2/3 of the user data it forwards to government agencies is handed over without a probable cause warrant. And it wants to change that. It wants to have government agencies actually get a warrant as opposed to just using the subpoena process for information that it's requiring from Google. I'm quoting from David Kravitz's article at Wired. Google requires an Electronic Communications Privacy Act search warrant for contents of Gmail and other services based on the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which prevents unreasonable search and seizure. So even though some courts have found that the Fourth Amendment may not protect your data, Google's taking a stand on this and saying, hey, law enforcement, you know, go through that extra hoop and get a warrant. Are you happy to hear that, Jason?
Well, overall, I think this is part of an increasing trend towards the privatization of our information. And I don't mean privatization in the sense that we get to have control over it. I mean that private companies get to have control over it and get to do stuff with it. But the government doesn't get to access it, or we have continued or even greater restrictions on government access to the information. I think all three of these stories tie together the same trend, which is that companies can have control over it, and they're going to maximize how much control they have over it and what they can do with it. But when the government or other entities want to get access to it, they're much more hesitant. And that's, to me, the most troubling trend, is this privatization by other entities of our information, the lack of control that we have, not with respect to the government, but with respect to private corporations.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, Evan, you want any? You want to weigh in on evidence and privacy and social media accounts, real quick, before we begin to wrap this up?
I was just intrigued when we were talking about the rights that the living have to access the social media of the dead, and you know this can take a number of different forms, and it seems like that there could be different standards, different sensibilities that the intermediary should hold themselves to when confronted with requests to access or to do something about the social media activity of someone who is now passed on. I'm reminded of a story from Virginia late in 2011. It was a family that was victimized by someone who had obtained unauthorized access to their mother's account, who had passed away, and they kept getting spam from her account. And so that's a way that there's real harassment going on because of what's going on with someone's digital life after they have passed on. So there's a number of different situations that could arise that give rise to these issues.
I'm not sure if I understood that properly, whether the spam was coming from beyond the grave or being dead didn't prevent you from getting spam, but either situation is untenable as far as I'm concerned.
The spam was coming from beyond the grave, or it appeared to have been, and right, yeah, it's all pretty untenable.
Yeah.
There is no spam in heaven, I know that much, so
we'll let's hope not. We cannot let Jason be on the show without discussing patents at all. I'm sorry that we haven't focused more on that, Jason, but let's do that right now. So there is much panic and hand-wringing out there coming up to March 16th, 2013, and something called the patent cliff that clearly was coined by some headline writer who wants to generate panic and consternation in the world. Is this something that people need to be panicking or concerned about, Jason?
I don't think they need to be panicking about the patent cliff. I think who really needs to be thinking about the patent cliff are attorneys, maybe inventors a little bit, but mostly patent attorneys. And any patent attorney who isn't aware of what's going to happen on March 16th, 2013 has been living under a rock for the last year and a half. I mean, everybody knows what's going to happen on March 16th, 2013. If you're in the patent game, it's going to be a shift to a first to file system as opposed to the first to invent system. It's going to have repercussions with respect to what counts as prior art and what doesn't count as prior art. And everyone knows this, and I think patent attorneys have been thinking about it and have been advising their clients, look, you should probably seriously consider filing before March 16th. And if you don't, there might be some negative consequences. So I think there is something big that's going to happen on March 16th, but it's something that has been coming for a long time, and everybody should be well prepared for it by this point. I think we're going to see a bit of a rush to file before March 16th, and then maybe a drop off. But maybe not. I mean, there are going to be some fee reductions that take place due to this new microentity status after that. And so there might be people waiting until after March 16th to take advantage of those fee reductions. But do I think people should panic? I don't think so. I think everyone's known that this is coming.
Well, that's good. It sounds like we're not only going to be the best armed country as people, you know, buy up in anticipation of the assault weapons restrictions that are coming here in the U.S., but we're going to be the most patented country too if people are rushing to get everything filed by March 16th. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, although China has certainly been increasing the number of patents that have issued. So we may not be the most patented country for much longer.
All right. And also you mentioned there's some changing of the guard going on in the patent arena that could be important, that we're losing the head of the PTO.
Yes, Director Kappos will be stepping down next week. January 31st, I think, is when he said his last day will be. And that's going to be a big deal. He's implemented a number of broad changes at the PTO. It'll be interesting to see whether those changes continue. The last two directors have certainly had a very profound impact on the number of patents that have been granted. Under Director Dudas, it went way down. Under Director Kappos, it's gone up. So that's going to be something to really keep an eye on. That could be a major change.
Who's the replacement? Do we know?
No, there's an acting director. I can't remember who the acting director is, but there'll be an acting director. And then at some point, President Obama will nominate a new director for the PTO.
Okay. And anything about the third or not the third, the federal circuit that we should be paying attention to?
This is more of a gradual change, but over the last year and a half, there's been a substantial shift at the federal circuit. A number of judges have taken senior status or retired from the court altogether. Three new judges have been appointed, and there are three vacancies. So it's possible that by the end of the year, we could have a federal circuit bench that looks completely different than it looked 4 years ago. That could have some really significant consequences, particularly for what decisions the court grants en banc review of that might really change the law in that area.
Right. And for anyone who's not familiar, that is the circuit court, the appellate level court of the federal government that determines patent related issues. So it's sort of the Supreme Court for patents, although it is answerable to the Supreme Court. So very interesting to see shifts going on there. Jason, you'll have to keep us posted as things begin to shape up there and the new flavor of the court begins to make itself known. Let's go ahead and give you our resource and tip of the week. Our resource of the week got sent to me by a number of different folks who loved, as I did, the analysis of the contract between Bilbo Baggins and the dwarves that exists only in the movie of The Hobbit. There's a very abbreviated contract in the actual text. This is done by James Daly over at Wired. We've talked about James on the show before. He writes something called The Law and Superheroes and loves to sort of, you know, unpack in an actual legal way, fictional legal documents. And so he's done that with Bilbo's agreement with the dwarves, which is a thing of beauty in itself as a movie prop. They went to the trouble of drafting a very realistic legal document here that is very, very long and involved and does not just, you know, have a bunch of nonsense text. It's actually a lawyer must have written it. So it's pretty fun to try and unpack it and see what the ramifications of it are. So go over and check it out at Wired. It's in our discussion points on Delicious. And also our tip of the week goes right to what we were talking about a moment ago, who can access your online material after you are gone. And it's a great practical write-up over at Time by Katie Steinmetz there called Protecting Online Assets, 9 Ways to Safeguard Your Digital Legacy. And since things are so completely all over the map about this, I think that you know, it's something we've stressed before and it's worth stressing again. You really need to consider what you're going to do about this. And I don't care how old you are. If you have an online presence at all, you need to be thinking about, you know, what your various digital assets are and what's going to happen to them when you're gone. And there's a very nice write-up here about how you can begin to do that, the steps that you should take. Evan, have you done any of this yourself? I know I still need to.
No, and I'm with so many Americans who haven't even taken, you know, full care of those portions of my estate that would need disposition in the event of my demise, you know, in the analog sense. So, you know, it's all aspirational, but you know, it's a good suggestion from that we have from this article to take care of this stuff, because it could certainly keep things tidy, you know, in all respects like this.
Right. So definitely go check it out. It will help you get started with that. And with that, we will go ahead and bid a fond farewell to this episode of This Week in Law. And all of you who've tuned in with us live and have listened after the fact, we're so grateful that you have done so, and so grateful to our great panel for joining us today. Venkat, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Jason, wonderful to chat with you, and I hope you'll come back. Oh, I think we may have you on mute, or perhaps you muted yourself. There you go.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
Glad we could hear from you and say farewell. And Evan, great chatting with you.
Yes, the same. Yeah, good time. Let me just plug something real quick here.
Sure.
Tonight, if you're, this is only for folks who are listening to this live. Tonight on ABC's 2020, they'll be doing a story about the Monty Teo. He's the Notre Dame football player, fake girlfriend story guy. One of the guests on 2020 discussing the legal issues with that is Dahlia Saper. Longtime watchers and listeners of the show will remember her from TWIL episode 131. So she's going to be on 2020 tonight talking about that. She was involved in a very factually similar case that went all the way up to the Illinois Supreme Court a few years ago. Check out 2020 tonight and watch for Dahlia Saper. And people in IRC are making fun of how I pronounced Monty Teo's name. I just read it.
I won't even try.
Yeah. And watch that tonight.
That's great. Thank you so much, Evan. And thank you all for joining us. You can find the entire archive of shows over there at twit.tv/twill, going back to episode one of This Week in Law. So I'm not suggesting that you try and listen to them all, but we have done quite a few at this point. So we're glad that you can access them there, and that you can join us every week at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1900 UTC at twit.tv when we record this show live. Between the shows, please visit our Facebook page and our Google Plus page. And particularly this week, since I'd like to really get your help in getting coverage of the copyright issues around MEGA and the privacy issues or benefits of the service, if you're running across stuff like that as you're reading through your work this week, send it my way and Evan's way. I'm Denise at twit.tv. He is Evan at twit.tv, because we'd love to get our arms around the mega story that is MEGA. So that's it for This Week in Law. We've loved being with you, and we will see you next week. Take care.